So that reading, the translation of the Dhamma talk of Ajahn Chah was done by Kirisaro, who was a Dhamma brother of mine. He was ordained by Ajahn Chah in 1977 as a bhikkhu and lived as a monk for about 17 years and now lives in South Africa with his wife Tanisra, who is also one of the presenters this weekend and was also formerly a nun in our community. So now I'd like to invite Ajahn Jitendriya, who is one of the nuns of our community, but she is one of the people amongst the presenters who didn't meet Ajahn Chah. And we thought that this would be a very suitable way of moving into the weekend of so the view of Ajahn Chah from a distance, of one who never met him personally but met his legacy and has received that legacy and has given their lives to that. So I'd like to now invite Ajahn Jitendriya. She's been living at Abhayagiri Monastery here in California with us for a couple of years now. She's been ordained as a nun for 11 years, yeah. Originally from Australia.
The only reason I accepted the invitation to speak first was because I thought it was such a good idea to have someone who didn't know Ajahn Chah to speak first, and who wasn't a monk and has never been a monk, at least in this lifetime. So that overcame my shyness because I thought it was a good idea. So even though I never met Ajahn Chah, I met him and got to know him through the eyes and hearts of those who had lived with him and trained with him and who loved him very much. When I first came to Amaravati Monastery, it was in 1987, and outwardly I looked fine, but inwardly I was hanging off the end of a rope. I was booked on a 10-day retreat. And I remember thinking to myself, if this doesn't work, I don't know what will. And that first retreat, I was fairly new to meditation, happened to be Ajahn Amaro who was teaching that retreat. And he introduced me to Ajahn Chah, the teachings of the Buddha, and his own experience of meeting Ajahn Chah, finding himself in Thailand, finding himself at the monastery. So my first impressions were the stories that he told, and through the years, the stories that I heard from Lumpo Sumedho and all the others who had lived with him. The wisdom of Ajahn Chah stood out immediately, as is quoted on the back of today's brochure, today's program. The language of wisdom is a language of the heart. It doesn't matter what language it's spoken in. It's recognized in the heart. And when I heard the way Ajahn Chah taught and just the way he lived, it was obvious to me that this man was a master, that he had attained what needed to be attained, had done what needed to be done in the Buddha's way of training. He was speaking from a place of freedom, utterly beyond any boundaries, being bound by any conventions. And that spoke directly to the longing in my own heart for that same kind of freedom I knew was possible. But to actually hear it from, as I say, I didn't meet him, but to hear it from someone who was with him, and the stories of how he manifested that wisdom and freedom in his life was extremely enriching. And through the living vehicle of a Western monastic sangha, actually brought it even more to life, because not only was this man speaking from a place of freedom that my own heart recognized, but the legacy of that was this monastic family, which whose heart was also open to me, whose way was open to me. And within a year of contacting the teachings, I decided to ordain, having come to know the community and Ajahn Sumedho and the wisdom of the teachers in the community. Those first impressions of Ajahn Shah, I have to pinch other people's stories, so I'm going to recall my memory of a couple of stories that Ajahn Amaro told, and I didn't go over these with him, so they might be way off the mark, but they're my memories. They've stayed with me as first impressions of meeting Ajahn Shah. So here I am in Ajahn Amaro's body, kind of finding my way to Wat Pa Phong. And first sight of this man, a short, round Thai man, a monk, one amongst many, helping to build the monastery toilets, sleeves rolled up, arms, hands getting dirty, right in there doing what needed to be done. This inspired me tremendously. This was a master. There's no podiums, no frills, no fanfare, no fuss. Just getting in there doing what needed to be done. Something said, yes, that's real. That's very real. And then the next image that stayed with me was when Ajahn Amaro slept in one morning and didn't make it to morning puja. So frantically making his way to the sala, only to meet Ajahn Chah coming out, puja was over. Oh my God, what was the master going to say? He's staring at him, looking him straight in the eyes, probably shaking in his thongs or boots, whatever you're wearing. Extremely embarrassed, fear-stricken, what's he going to say? You know, the standard of discipline in these monasteries were very high. Ajahn Chah looks him straight in the eye and, sleep is delicious, and walks away. Ah, there it is. Wonderful, crystal clear wisdom just says it how it is. Sleep is delicious. It's the way it is. Now, I don't know if these stories are true. This is the way I remember them. And I didn't want to check with him before because I wouldn't have anything else to say. So those are a couple of the first impressions that have obviously stayed with me for 13, 14 years. And the stories that came after that about this man and the way he lived with his disciples and taught them in everyday living situations, not just getting up on the Dhamma seat once or twice a week, but being with his disciples, hanging out with them and doing things with them and continually pointing out what the practice was and what needed to be done. And a couple of anecdotes that come to mind was when he came across a large log on a path in the monastery and wanted to move it, and he called one of the monks over to help him move the log. And he gets at one end and he indicates to the monk to pick the other end up, and they pick it up and he says, "Is this heavy?" And the monk just looks and they toss it off into the woods, and he says to him, "Is it heavy now?" This is a direct teaching, is what we have to do with the stuff that we pick up, like this poisonous cobra. What do we do with our mental activity and our moods? As long as we pick it up and keep it and call it me and mine, it becomes very heavy. And he's pointing to the simplicity of the practice in terms of all you have to do is just let it go. And it's not heavy anymore. The log in itself is only heavy if you try to pick it up. Or as other masters have said, the mountain is only heavy if you try to move it. And another little anecdote. He saw a monk with a tape recorder taking the plug out of the socket, and he got an electric shock, dropped it straight away. He said, "Ooh, who told you to do that?" You know, if something hurts, you drop it. And again, the simple teaching of recognize dukkha. If it hurts, drop it. That's all you have to do. Our problem is that we think this dukkha, this pain is me and mine, and we hang on to it because we're so afraid to let it go. In the meantime, we suffer, suffer, suffer. But just recognize painful, drop. It's a truth in nature. We just have to, bring our minds around to recognizing it. So it's these kind of simple but incredibly profound teachings, obviously coming from a freed heart, was there on the spot. Now, I never lived with him, so I never got a chance to get disillusioned with him. Perhaps you'll hear of some people's disappointments and disillusionment with the Master, which is inevitably part of the teaching, because Masters aren't perfect either. And hopefully we'll hear some of those stories today. But for me, when I heard those stories of other people's disappointments and disillusionments, they were already teachings again. So they were profound and meant to be. So I could not ever be disillusioned with those things that I heard, because they always provided a teaching which enabled the person who was experiencing that teaching to understand something even more profound in terms of clinging to the teacher, clinging to the idea that wisdom comes from outside, or that I need someone else to show me who I am or where my wisdom is or how to be free. And Ajahn Chah, it seems, was a master at pointing people back to their own minds. Ajahn Sumedho might tell the story later on, when he wanted Ajahn Chah to affirm for him whether he'd attained a certain degree of insight or not. And Ajahn Chah said, "How should I know? It's your mind, you need to know yourself." And throughout the teachings that you read and hear, he was saying that again and again to people. And one teaching that comes to mind, which is a very favourite one of mine, he talked a lot about anicca, or impermanence. To see the impermanent nature of things is truly the way to free ourselves. And the impermanent nature of even of attainments, or the idea of attainments. So in one little teaching, he says, if the mind tries to tell you you're a Sotapanna now, or stream enterer, then find that Sotapanna and bow to him. When you bow to him, he'll tell you nothing sure. If you meet a Sakyadagami or a once returner, go and bow to him. He'll tell you even more, nothing sure, everything's uncertain. If you meet an Anagami, a non-returner, go and bow to him. He'll tell you it's even more uncertain. And if you meet an Arahant, go and bow to him. He'll tell you even more, it's all uncertain. And this is a profound teaching, particularly for me, but I'm sure for all of us, because as practitioners, sincere practitioners, we get into the rut of thinking there's something to be attained, or that something to be gotten rid of, that I've got to change somehow. And we get caught into that same rut of trying to become something. And the teaching that Ajahn Chah is pointing to again and again, and it's not about that at all, it's just about seeing the way things are, that everything is impermanent. And that is the only insight that brings us around to true freedom. There's nothing to be attained. There's one quote that comes to mind. He said, I think I'll read it. He said, "I don't know with whom to talk about it. We talk about things to be developed and things to give up, but there's really nothing to develop and nothing to give up." I don't know when he said that, but I got the sense that perhaps it was in the later part of his life, when he'd done so much training and teaching. There's a great feeling of dispassion about those words. So it's not as if we don't train, because this monk, when you hear about the stories of his life, the way he trained was phenomenal. He was incredibly sincere and devoted himself 150% to the practice and never gave up. His courage was tremendous, and there's lots of stories of his own battles with lust and doubt and fear. So it took a tremendous amount for him to come to that understanding. So it's not something to be taken lightly, but it is the essence of the teaching. But in order to realize it, we do have to get to know ourselves very well, and that takes a lot of work and a lot of training. So I feel incredibly indebted to Ajahn Chah. He's like my spiritual grandfather, a grandfather I never met, but without whom I wouldn't be here in this form as Sister Jitendriya, because I don't think Ajahn Sumedho would be here, or Ajahn Amaro, or any of the Western Sangha. You'll hear later today how Ajahn Chah had something about him and the way he taught that attracted Westerners. He couldn't speak English, but many Westerners were attracted to him. And I felt that in my own heart. There was something about his teaching and his wisdom, his way of speaking, that transcended all cultural boundaries, but it felt very familiar from the first time I heard it. He even looked a bit like my grandmother, actually. There was a sense of familiarity and love. He didn't talk a lot about metta. He talked a lot about how to realize wisdom. And I asked one of the Ajahns the other day about Ajahn Chah teaching metta. He said he didn't have to teach it that much. He just oozed it. And this is what you miss out when you don't have that personal contact with the master. You can get into a rut of struggling with, trying to be perfect like he was, struggling with all the defilements and trying to become the quintessential Tudanga monk. So I found myself in a bit of a rut there, since I was never going to be that. But what I realized is not to emulate Ajahn Chah the way he appeared, but to really take to heart the essence of his teachings, which transcended all forms of language. So I offer that for your reflection.